Chapter 3. Exposing the Cracks in the Foundation. For some people, open relating and CNM are catalysts for tremendous personal growth and expansion. As Dedeker Winston recalls in her book, The Smart Girl's Guide to Polyamory, of her personal journey in polyamory, quote, "All of the highs, lows, and wrong turns have been an intense education about myself. What makes me tick, what sets me off, what turns me on, and what truly brings me happiness. I have found the power to craft relationships that fulfill and energize, and I have discovered more love, security, affection, trust, and stability than ever before." Unquote. Along with increased personal discovery, this journey can also initiate beautiful opportunities for partners to learn new things together, enhance their communication, deepen their intimacy, and expand their eroticism. This potential to change our lives in such profound ways is a big reason why so many individuals and partners continue to explore and practice CNM. But as many already know, it also presents some significant challenges as well. The further we step outside the constructs of monogamy, the more we inevitably come to see our relationships through new eyes, and sometimes we may not like what we see. Whether you are brand new to CNM or have been living some form of it for years, the changes that come as you or your partners develop new relationships can radically alter your life in unpredictable ways. For many, the changes that CNM can bring act like a pressure cooker, heating things up and bringing to the surface all kinds of feelings, issues, and dynamics that you were potentially never aware of, such as unprocessed trauma, unresolved ruptures, power imbalances, lingering resentments, poor communication habits, codependency, or even deal-breaking incompatibilities. As CNM forces us to confront some of the exposed cracks in the foundation of our relationships, it can be helpful to remember they are not necessarily the result of personal shortcomings on our part, but often the remnants of relational dynamics that were most likely masked by the closed container of monogamy or the ostensible security of more hierarchical polyamory. The increased complexity of CNM can often put quite a spotlight on the things that were previously invisible to us or at least tolerable in a context of exclusivity or more domestic or entwined CNM partnerships. Once exposed, it is important to figure out whether these cracks can be addressed and repaired, or whether they are signs of a relationship that is beyond saving. As we take a closer look at some of the more common cracks that can show up in relationships, you may identify one or more of these issues that shows up in your own. Some of the relationship cracks that get exposed through CNM transitions, such as codependency and with unresolved conflict from the past, are addressed in later chapters. But for now, we'll focus on some other common cracks that Dave and I both see lots of partners grappling with, such as dysfunctional communication dynamics and relationship neglect, as well as discerning when the cracks in a relationship are just too big to resolve. Dysfunctional communication dynamics. I'm going to wash your mouth out with soap. My maternal grandmother was a true character. Everyone who knew her called her Grandma Marshmallow because she would give marshmallows to all the neighborhood children. If you briefly met her, you'd think, what a sweet old lady. But to all of her immediate family, while she was at times very sweet and extremely generous, her persistent complaints, judgments, and standards that few could ever meet also made her difficult to deal with. My grandmother had a fierce passion for social justice, and in her days of political activism, she was willing to fight and even risk her life for equal rights for all. In the day-to-day, her strong sense of what was right and wrong regularly showed up in how she grandparented me and my cousins. As kids, we loved to play tricks on her, putting marbles in her shoes or turning all the encyclopedias on her bookshelf upside down just to get a rise out of her. One day, all of us grandkids were hiding after putting her favorite frog statue in the freezer. She was frustrated and searching around to find and punish us when one of us blurted out a curse. Well, that was a mistake, because Grandma quickly went from frustrated to fierce. We were three urban kids with permissive parents, so we probably didn't think cursing at Grandma would be that big of a deal, but we clearly underestimated our verbal offense. And our angry grandma got a bar of soap and proceeded to chase us all around her apartment yelling, "I'm gonna wash your mouth out with soap." Lesson learned, don't curse in front of grandma. Through most of my adolescence and early 20s, I was frequently and reluctantly recruited into the fights between my mother and grandmother. My grandmother got jealous when my mom spent time with anyone but her. And her way of dealing with her desire for more time with my mom was to sling criticism and accusations about anybody my mom spent time with. No matter how much time and attention we gave my grandmother, it was never enough. In these continuous arguments, the comments that left my grandmother's mouth were at times so outrageous that it was actually comical to me, but understandably, my mother would get highly defensive and upset. Sometimes I just stayed out of it. Other times I tried to join in with the same level of intensity to defend my mom and break it up. At still other times, I would try to act as the voice of reason to diffuse the situation. And many times I was even able to mediate between the two of them and support my grandmother in sharing her actual feelings and needs instead of her harsh judgments. But even if we made situational progress where my grandmother would calm down and actually apologize to my mom, a few days or weeks later, she would start the same cycle all over again. It was their codependent toxic tango, and it was so incredibly exhausting for me that I got to the point where I didn't want to spend time with the two of them together anymore. Finally, one day, while the two of them were once again embroiled in the same dysfunctional banter, at my wit's end, with no more skill or technique to throw at the situation, I just blurted out, "Grandma, do I need to wash your mouth out with soap?" I stopped her right in her tracks. She paused and then innocently said, "But I'm not cursing." And I replied, "You're technically not cursing, but what's coming out of your mouth is just as mean and maybe even worse than cursing." As a woman who had literally devoted her life to the pursuit of peace and justice, it wasn't until that moment in her 80s that she finally saw the discrepancy between the fight she had enacted in the world for women and people of color to attain equal rights, and how that same energy of fight had turned her into the very villain with her family that she had no tolerance for out there in the world. With her defenses down, I followed up with, "Grandma, if you want to have peace and connection with mom, then you have to speak with peace and connection to mom." Something finally changed after that. Lesson learned. From the story I just shared, it's probably no surprise how I came to be a mediator and a therapist. Some of the most powerful moments I experience in my work are with partners who, by slowing down together and receiving a few helpful prompts from me, are able to restore their connection after being stuck and disconnected for some time. When people already love and care about each other, the potential for growth and transformation is tremendous and always a gift to witness. And when people love and care about each other, the potential to treat each other worse than anyone else is equally tremendous. And it is heartbreaking to witness. My least favorite moments as a therapist are the ones where, like with my mother and grandmother, I get enlisted into playing referee between partners or metamors who are dishing out one nasty, resentful, disrespectful allegation after another. In the world of relationship therapy, there are specialized trainings tailored just to working with high-conflict partnerships because, as a practitioner, it's one of the most challenging dynamics to deal with in the therapy room. Part of the challenge is that the intensity of the session can easily trigger our own fight, flight, freeze response or our own personal trauma history as we witness partners spew venom and attack each other. Also, the pressure that non-monogamy can put on a relationship has the power to make partners who were previously pleasant and kind become hostile and harsh, reacting in ways that neither of them has ever seen before. And while I've picked up many tips and tricks along the way to better handle these dynamics, sometimes it's just like it was with Grandma Marshmallow, where there is a temporary de-escalation within the container of the therapy session, but after a few days or weeks, the pattern just continues all over again. Or worst case scenario, the technique simply doesn't work at all. As I've continued to encounter more and more partners in my private practice who would express outright contempt and disdain for each other, I started leaving sessions somewhat dysregulated and honestly dumbfounded by my clients' capacity to talk to each other in ways that they would never dare speak to anyone else. The behaviors included harmful communication patterns such as interrupting one another while speaking, rolling their eyes, speaking for their partner without permission, telling their partner who they really are or aren't as a person, making negative assumptions about their partner's intentions, labeling, name-calling, blaming, criticizing, getting defensive, having reactive outbursts, being competitive, comparing partners to other people, and withholding care and affection as leverage to meet personal needs. Given that these partners were telling me some version of the story that this toxic way of relating was directly the result of their open relationship, I could recognize the patterns as symptoms of the CNM changes or new CNM paradigm stress they were under. However, in extreme cases, even with that recognition, I didn't always know how to help them. After finally reaching my wit's end, I threw in my therapeutic towel and began serving up my version of the "Grandma, do I need to wash your mouth out with soap?" intervention. Please know that I have never actually uttered those particular words in a session, but I do admit to coming pretty close in moments. Here are some highlights. "Wow, you two, are you aware of how you're talking to one another? I don't think you mean to, but this is really hurtful and damaging, even abusive language I'm hearing. Is this what you're wanting? I'm going to pause you all. By the way you're acting towards each other, I'm having trouble seeing that you even like each other. It actually seems like you despise each other. Is that the case? Are you wanting to pay me to watch you fight? Or would you like to have a different kind of conversation that shifts this between you all? Okay, let me pause you. Do you talk to the grocery clerk this way or your boss? There's a level of basic human kindness and respect that's missing here. I know you're both hurting, but without basic respect and kindness, forget about doing non-monogamy together. Or with anyone for that matter, because there's no relationship at all." Statements like these typically have the effect of getting people's attention and cutting through the interference caused by the unskillful communication of their unregulated nervous systems. In the opening that is created, I can reflect my firm belief that it is precisely this way of relating to each other that needs immediate attention before we talk about anything related to CNM. It's hard to talk tenderly about the hard stuff and come up with shared solutions in the absence of care and respect. No matter what has already transpired in the relationship, talking to each other in such destructive ways only adds more fuel to the fire. and chisels away at the safety and trust needed to do CNM together. At this point, I typically ask three questions. Do you believe you can change these unhelpful ways of communicating? Has your behavior become abusive or out of control? And does it require more intensive intervention? And are these patterns an indication that you are actually done with the relationship or potentially should be? In the book, The 7 Principles for Making Marriage Work, John Gottman and Nan Silver refer to these hurtful ways of treating our partners as the four horsemen of the apocalypse. This is a metaphor Gottman uses to describe the four predominant communication patterns he sees playing out in relationships that consistently struggle with conflict. Through decades of research, Gottman has developed the ability to predict the end of a relationship with an over 90% accuracy rate, primarily based on whether or not these four common patterns are present in the partner's communication. While individuals may know that the ways they communicate feel awful and unproductive, leaving them even more disconnected and less understood, they don't always recognize their part in the dynamic or see how destructive the pattern is, or they just can't control themselves. As far as I know, Gottman's work has focused primarily on monogamous couples. If he has targeted the overwhelming likelihood that these kinds of communication patterns will tank a monogamous relationship, what can we expect in the case of an open relationship where the triggers are guaranteed to be multiplied exponentially? While it is true that many of these problematic communication patterns can be changed through sincere and diligent practice, the consequence of not changing them is the end of the relationship. Many of the people coming to see me want to start their process by focusing on and healing the lingering pain of the ruptures that were caused by opening up their relationship or the CNM transitions they are in. They consciously identified the questionable behaviors that were hurtful, intentionally or unintentionally, and want to do the work necessary to make repairs. However, doing deep repair work is contraindicated when such communication patterns are in play. Whenever Gottman's four horsemen are present in partners' communication dynamics, we have to begin with the basic foundational work of creating safety and respect first. Before we can seriously take on repairing painful events from the past or sharing in ways that are vulnerable and intimate, there has to be at least a baseline of safety and healthy communication to move forward. The following chart is an outline of Gottman's four horsemen, along with antidotes for each way of relating. You can see chart 3.1 in the accompanying PDF. Sometimes the presence of one or more of the four horsemen is an indication, on some level, that partners don't actually like each other, or that they are over the relationship and just haven't been able to fully realize or admit it yet. In other cases, it is more of a sign that partners are in stress, stuck in trigger mode, or in non-monogamous paradigm shock with each other. And these patterns are simply the symptoms of the accumulated tension. In still other situations, the four horsemen are, unfortunately, the only way partners have learned to communicate, and they simply don't have healthier models to follow. Or maybe they resort to these ways of communicating because their partner has been using the four horsemen on them. Whatever the case may be, it's important to figure out whether your use or your partner's use of the four horsemen is a primary issue in and of itself, or if it is a reflection of an, quote, I don't actually like you anymore, unquote, situation. If you have been stuck in a dynamic with the four horsemen and speaking to your partner in ways that are disrespectful and unkind, I challenge you to consider the following questions to better determine whether the four horsemen are your primary issue or indicative of something even bigger. Do you like who your partner is and how they are in the world? Do you respect who your partner is and how they are in the world? Did you never really like them in the first place? Or did your respect and appreciation for them diminish once the honeymoon hormones wore off or certain life stressors arose? Do you see your partner as fundamentally mean, cruel, selfish, narcissistic, manipulative, etc.? In other words, do you consider these things as personality traits versus occasional behaviors where your partner could learn better ways of emotionally coping or expressing themselves? Did you used to like or respect your partner, but one or both of you has changed through the years, and they are no longer someone you would choose to be with if you met them today? Is there too much resentment, betrayal, conflict, abuse, or toxicity getting in the way of your relationship? And do you believe the situation is repairable? Do you have physical or sensory aversions to the way your partner looks, sounds, feels, or smells? Are you actually done with this relationship and haven't been able to come to terms with this clarity yet? If the presence of the four horsemen in your relationship is more of an issue around communication and emotional regulation, and represents the primary problem, there is still hope that you and your partner can learn kinder and more respectful ways of talking to each other. However, if you answered yes to one or more of the previous questions, and there is some part of you harboring deep-seated disrespect, disdain, resentment, loathing, or chronic irritation, then it's really important to be honest about these feelings and assess whether or not the possibility of working through the issues together is realistic or even wanted. For some, it's quite possible these difficult feelings arose as a result of a traumatic event in the relationship or in response to years of accumulated stress, mistreatment, and negative relationship patterns. Maybe the dynamics were different in the beginning, but now the love has become clouded by the influence of these unfortunate occurrences. Whatever the case may be, it's critical to give yourself permission to be done with the relationship and move on, if that's what is really called for, of course. Or to at least create the space where you can work on these issues together to start reducing the prevalence of the toxicity. Interestingly, I have seen partners who have literally shocked me with the intensity of their poor communication, leaving me completely convinced they were done for, only to later be pleasantly surprised by the assurance they wanted nothing more than to stay together. To their credit, they took me pointing out how disrespectful and mean their treatment to each other was as a wake-up call, and seriously reflected on how it was not their intention to be this way, realizing that they genuinely liked, adored, and appreciated one another. The key is to suss out whether or not there is actually enough desire, energy, and willingness to work things out and keep the relationship going. In order to get an accurate sense of this, you have to figure out whether the problems you face are a matter of changing the existing communication patterns between you and your partners, or are more reflective of the potential end of your relationship. Whatever the case may be, you first have to address the presence of the four horsemen and determine whether they are a symptom of problematic communication patterns or a sign that your relationship either needs a break or has actually reached its end. Relationship neglect and justice jealousy. Another crack that I often see getting exposed in times when a relationship opens up or when new CNM partners connect within a polycule is relationship neglect. After years in the same relationship, we easily fall into grooves and get comfortable with the way things are. As we start to zone out and get caught up in the hamster wheel of daily life, our efforts to stoke the flames of romance or show appreciation for our partners can dwindle. And while it is unrealistic to expect that we maintain the same level of focus, intensity, and libido as we did at the beginning of the relationship, there is a difference between the inevitable decline of new relationship energy, NRE, and actually neglecting our partners. Rarely do I see relationship neglect as something that a partner is intentionally doing. More often, it is the unintentional ways that partners fall into the trap of getting too comfortable, undervaluing each other, forgetting to show appreciation, becoming romantically apathetic, no longer trying, ignoring each other, making assumptions, projecting discontent, struggling with stress management, and even starting to get bored with each other. That can be the issue. What may initially start as minor ways of taking your partner for granted in time becomes the increasing absence of certain types of important connection, intimacy, and sex. Unfortunately, I've come to see relational neglect as a major obstacle in the path to partners moving forward with CNM. And if left unchecked, it can be a leading cause in the demise of the relationship. While obviously taking a partner for granted needs to be addressed in any relationship, in the context of open relationships, it can be the absolute last straw that brings a partnership to the edge of collapse. When a faithful and loving partner sees their previously checked out, distracted, or romantically apathetic counterpart suddenly be revived by their desire for someone new, it can shine a harsh and glaring light on what's been missing. This unbearable experience of seeing a partner swept up in NRE while feeling forgotten, like yesterday's news, produces a particularly painful kind of challenge that I refer to as justice jealousy. I remember sitting with Dave in our car on one typically gray and rainy summer afternoon in Santa Cruz, California, regretting that I had forgotten my umbrella. As we waited for the rain to slow down a bit, we started to talk about a particular dynamic in our relationship. We were early for the dinner reservations I had made for us at a new health food restaurant that I knew Dave would like, so there was no rush. We hadn't had a date night in a while, so I was really looking forward to the evening. After dinner, I had arranged for us to see a movie, for which I had already bought the tickets and picked out Dave's favorite seats. Can you see where this is going? So even though I genuinely enjoyed creating a date night experience for us, I was becoming aware of how I wanted to be on the receiving end of date night planning for a change. As we talked in the car, I shared with Dave that I was starting to feel the imbalance of always being the one to make the plans for our date nights. I acknowledged that it was something I didn't mind doing and actually enjoyed, but it would mean a lot for him too, for once, to step up and take that on as well. I said I literally didn't care what the plan would be, a stroll on the boardwalk, a picnic in the park, or playing Miss Pac-Man at the arcade. It didn't need to be expensive, elaborate, or even a traditional date in any way. I just wanted him to take the initiative and create an experience for me. I wanted more romance. I wanted to feel him turn towards me with interest and excitement. After saying my piece, Dave seemed to get it and agreed he would try. Fast forward several years to us now living in Boulder, Colorado, where we were parents and polyamorous together. We were relatively new in our process of open relating, but Dave already had a particular woman in mind with whom he had a special connection. I was in complete support of their relationship, and when he mentioned they wanted to plan a getaway together to further explore their connection, I had no problem with it. A few days later, I was sitting in my office between client sessions when all of a sudden I get a text from Airbnb, providing me with the verification code I needed to complete the booking for my upcoming trip to Denver. A wave of fury moved through my body and an indignant, "Oh, hell no," shot out of my mouth. Mind you, not because I didn't want them to have their adventure together, but because I knew that at that very moment, Dave was logged into my Airbnb account trying to book them a trip that I was now going to be recruited into helping make happen. A few seconds later, without missing a beat, I received the text from Dave asking if I had gotten his precious verification code and if I could forward it to him. I was furious and I was hurt. To put my reaction into further context, we have to return to the conversation that took place in Santa Cruz a few years earlier. As I said, I was wanting Dave to initiate more romance in the relationship. And to be honest, it wasn't the first or the last time we would have the same conversation. As much as I knew Dave loved and valued me, the change I was hoping for didn't happen. I would get beautifully handwritten cards and specially cooked meals on holidays and birthdays, which I still get and adore. The bathroom would be regularly cleaned, and he would unconditionally support my career. But the work of tending to our romantic relationship most often fell on my shoulders. I eventually gave up, resigned to the fact that it wasn't personal to me or even our relationship, but instead just wasn't who he was. And so I decided to focus on all the other ways he was an amazing partner. But then along comes another woman, and all of a sudden, he's giving her the very things I've been requesting all these years? Suddenly now he has the skills and capacity to create an experience for her when I had just resigned myself to the idea he was fundamentally incapable of doing so? You better believe I was seething with justice jealousy. Justice jealousy is different from the more typical types of jealousy where you feel possessive of your partner, insecure about your standing in the relationship, or covetous of the other person's experiences. Instead, it is a direct response to an action taken by your partner that leaves you feeling like the victim of an injustice. It is typically a reaction to a situation like mine, where you've been asking your partner for a certain behavior, experience, change in the dynamic, or expression of your preferred love language, seemingly to no avail because, try as you might, it keeps not happening. Then, as you start to accept you will probably never get it, or assume your partner is simply not capable of such things, you suddenly see them giving that very thing to someone else. It's infuriating and feels very personal. It feels like a rejection, and it directly exposes the experience of being taken for granted and neglected in your relationship.
Dave here. As painful and uncomfortable as it can be to acknowledge the way I hurt Jessica with this kind of dynamic, it's only right that I own up to it. Simply reading her account of the situation still makes me cringe with embarrassment as I reflect on the level of disconnect and unconsciousness that was at play. I even remember the reaction I had during some of those previous conversations with Jessica about her desire for more initiative on my part and how it felt like she was asking me to be someone else. I felt so much resistance, and it was extremely difficult to not take it as a personal criticism of who I fundamentally am instead of her asking for my behaviors to change and for me to grow in ways that could have benefited us both. I was never a good planner and got easily overwhelmed when having to make things happen, especially if it had to do with scheduling and making reservations online. I also see how my tendency to identify as a spontaneous person fed into the avoidance of logistical forethought. And frankly, I was grateful Jessica was someone who liked to plan and handle that side of things. Thankfully, I've come a long way since then and become much more assertive and engaged when it comes to initiating and planning romance. However, at that point in our relationship, I still didn't have the emotional maturity to realize how the imbalance in our dynamic was a symptom of some pretty toxic complacency on my part, as well as codependency between us. I just didn't see how my avoidance of learning new behaviors in the relationship was actually indicative of taking Jessica for granted, because I assumed she would just keep taking care of it. I was asleep at the wheel, and genuinely couldn't see how my laziness in the romance department was leaving Jessica feeling neglected and uncared for. Sadly, as I look back, I can now recognize how this glaring gap in my relational intelligence really laid the foundation for our romantic separation, which came just a few years later. In all honesty, it wasn't until we opened our relationship and I saw other men shower her with affection and eagerly organize romantic adventures for her that I realized just how little I had shown up for her in that way. Seeing her light up as she received all this new attention was a brutal reflection of how checked out I had been all those years. And even though I scrambled to start showing some initiative in our relationship, at that point, it was way too little, way too late. Looking back, I can now see that I was living with the idea that Jessica and I would always be together, no matter what. My folks have been married for over 50 years and my brother for over 20. I'm literally the first person in my immediate family to get divorced, as strange as that may seem these days. I had never even entertained the possibility we could split up. And I can see now how my lack of experience with big relationship loss really played into a pretty significant blindness on my part. Some part of me, albeit mostly unconscious, really thought we would be together till death do us part. Taking for granted that we would always be together meant, on some level, I didn't have to work as hard on the romance part of our relationship. It was only after I started dating again in the CNM context that I realized just how important this element of intimacy was. Having to watch my romantic circuits come online with other women after longing for it in our marriage became the perfect setup for Jessica's justice jealousy. This is one of the single most dangerous yet common pitfalls of monogamy or long-term domestic relationships, which I see play out over and over again with people in my private practice. The relative ease, predictability, and familiarity of the daily routine, coupled with the closed container of exclusivity, creates the perfect set of circumstances for partners to start taking each other for granted. To be perfectly honest, it's not that surprising. With the overwhelming array of logistics the average couple has to juggle these days, it's no wonder we start to let things slide, especially if everything seems okay on the surface. And there's the rub. When it comes to intimacy, you simply cannot go on autopilot and assume anything, ever. You have to stay engaged, interested, and curious, and not fall into the trap of thinking you have your partners all figured out. People change, as do their needs and wants, and we have to be tuned in enough to recognize those changes as they arise. Intimacy and romance are not like an investment portfolio you can simply outsource to someone else, stop paying attention to, and expect easy returns from. It is a living, breathing, complex organism that is always in flux and in need of constant tending. While the particular features of romance and intimacy can and should look different for every relationship, the intention to be an active and mutually engaged participant is vital.
Jessica again. Relationship neglect and justice jealousy are not just issues for newly opened couples. Both these challenges frequently show up in long-term CNM relationships, or even relatively new ones, typically after someone even newer enters the picture. For example, one of my clients who practices non-hierarchical polyamory was very close to a partner with whom she did not live. Despite the fact they did not live together, their relationship evolved to a point where their lives intertwined in some very intimate ways. They hosted parties together, she helped care for his home, and they even talked about making travel plans for the future. Since her partner kept pretty busy traveling for work, most of his other relationships were relatively casual. However, around 2 years into their relationship, he started to get more serious with another woman. Initially, my client had a positive metamour relationship with this new woman and was supportive of their relationship. But she began to struggle as she noticed this new partner was getting prioritized over her. Many of the special experiences she had been promised were now being offered to her metamour first. He began to travel with his new partner, integrate her into his friend group, and even offer her first choice of weekly date nights. My client was left feeling like she had been demoted to the status of domestic chore girl, where most of their time together was centered on either running errands for him or just hanging out at his house after he recovered from his more adventurous late-night dates with the new partner. As she began to get less and less time and attention from him, she initially judged herself for being, quote-unquote, jealous, feeling bad about her inability to be a, quote-unquote, good poly partner and metamore. But later, as we unpacked her experience in our sessions, she came to realize that she was actually experiencing a form of relationship neglect. And this realization finally allowed her to embrace her justice jealousy. The challenge of justice jealousy is one I frequently encounter when working with pre-existing polyamorous Vs, triads, or quads, where two or more partners predate the arrival of a new partner. It can be extremely triggering for the original partners who have been around for all the good, the bad, and the ugly to watch a partner become enamored with someone new and suddenly transform into uncharacteristically cheerful, attentive, agreeable, fun, sexy, or an all-around amazing partner in the presence of the new person. For the original partners, it can feel as though you are being left the emotional scraps while this new person, who hasn't had to deal with all the bullshit of your partner's lovable but complex personality, gets to just enjoy the splendor of their enthusiasm and presence. While in general, this can be a maddening experience, it is even more acute when you see it happening in your shared home or even bedroom. On the other side of the coin, sometimes this kind of relationship neglect can actually happen right from the start of a relationship. Some new partners can feel overlooked or undervalued because they occupy a less primary position than the metamores who predate them. Because they are considered secondary or satellite partners, including typically not living in the same space, their wants and needs in the relationship can often be treated as less important. Also, partners who practice styles of CNM, such as solo polyamory, or who are relationship anarchists, can experience their partners wrongfully assuming that their more independent and autonomous orientation means they need less attention, attunement, validation, or belonging, often leaving the impression their relationship is less important than those that have some form of hierarchy or status privilege. If you are in a situation where relationship neglect is at play, I suggest that you and your partners do your best to remedy this together by focusing on what you need to feel valued, attuned to, and appreciated. Left unattended to, justice jealousy can quickly erode your connection and precipitate the end of your relationship. If your partner is unable or unwilling to address the ways they have been neglecting you, then you need to have an honest conversation and reassess whether you are still really wanting the same things. After being explicit about what you really want, maybe you'll find you can change the expectations you have for this relationship to make it fit the needs of your current situation. Or you can find an arrangement that is better suited for you. When a companion marriage doesn't work for you. Another situation I see quite often, which can sometimes end up being problematic for at least one, if not both partners in open relationships, is the phenomenon I call the companion marriage. Typically, a companion marriage is one where a couple is living in the same space, possibly raising a family together, and sharing many aspects of domestic life that married couples normally do, but without the romance or sexual intimacy. In situations like these, it's possible for the individuals to genuinely enjoy each other's company and want to be around each other. They could have important shared interests, hobbies, or projects, but the relationship is lacking some sense of romantic spark or sexual polarity. It's a relationship that has become more platonic than passionate. In this dynamic, one or both partners will usually describe their partner as being more like a best friend or a close sibling than a lover. It's comfortable and safe, and partners often say they don't want to lose the familiarity and trust they have built together over the years. When couples find themselves in this situation and they both want it to continue as it is, opening up can be a fantastic way to maintain their life together while also having the opportunity to satisfy the desire for romantic or sexual experiences lacking in the current arrangement. As long as the companion marriage situation is completely mutual, it can be a great fit for CNM. However, when a companion marriage consists of one partner not wanting romance or sex, but the other one wanting them, the relationship itself is likely to become strained and ultimately unsustainable. Trying to incorporate CNM into a dynamic like this can often become a ticking time bomb, creating unbearable pain when a partner starts to see other people. Even though partners may lament the absence of sex or romance in a monogamous relationship, they will usually endure it because they know no one is really getting any. And there's typically enough good things in the relationship to warrant sticking it out. In monogamy, it's much easier to just chalk up a lack of sex to things like having a low sex drive, stress, or the old cliche that this is just what happens in long-term relationships. But when one partner still wants these things in their original relationship and the other partner doesn't, but is actively going out and getting those needs met somewhere else, it often becomes unmanageable and extremely difficult not to experience it as an outright rejection. For fear of losing the original relationship, numerous individuals try to accept seeing their partner with whom they've lost sexual intimacy be with other people. They twist themselves into emotional contortionists in an attempt to deal with the pain of watching their partners get swept up in the intoxicating flurry of NRE, all the while having to swallow their own yearning to feel sexy, attractive, and desired. In order to try and make the pain go away, people adamantly dismiss and minimize their own sexual needs or use pseudo-spiritual narratives about the nobility of loving their partner unconditionally, regardless of their acute and unremitting anguish. They wait and hope against all odds that their partner will see the light and finally turn towards them once again. Or they may even try to date other people in order to get their own needs met, while underneath it all being completely uninterested in the new relationship because all they really want is to be with their original partner. While there are various reasons why the phenomenon of companion marriage can happen, some of the more common are: you have incompatible views on what you want in a marriage or partnership, where some people are fine if marriage has little or no sex or romance, and some people are absolutely not. There's nothing wrong with either view of partnership, but they must be mutually shared enough for the partnership to work. You fell in love with who your partner was as a person, loving who they are, but you never really felt attracted to them in a romantic or primal kind of way. There initially was an attraction, but it's gone. You are no longer attracted to or in love with your partner, and no amount of therapy, toys, porn, tantra, role-playing, audio programs, increased emotional intimacy, or attachment repair has changed that. You have not successfully dealt with conflicts, so while things may be calm on the surface, one or both of you does not feel emotionally safe in the relationship. The lack of romance or sex could be a symptom of an avoidant relationship to having difficult but necessary conversations, or one or both of you being stuck in a freeze defense response. Also see chapter 4. When the cracks are too big. Sometimes it can be a tricky thing to figure out when it's time to leave a relationship. The fact that a relationship is going through a phase of intense conflict or faced with challenging life circumstances doesn't always mean it's time to throw in the towel. Every relationship has its ups and downs, and even the most loving and compatible partnerships can get tested. I definitely don't believe relationships should just be discarded when things get hard, and I acknowledge the importance of doing everything we can to make things work before walking away. So far in this chapter, we have covered relationship cracks and challenges that theoretically can be remedied if all partners are willing and able. Respect and kindness for each other can be embraced. Unhealthy communication patterns can improve. Past ruptures can be repaired. Relationship neglect can be redressed. And in some cases, an imbalanced romantic or sexual desire in a companion marriage can even be restored, accepted as is, or remedied with CNM. Awareness of these issues creates an opportunity to improve them. However, unfortunately, in some situations, the cracks in a relationship are just too big to be mended. Sometimes partners simply come to realize they have just grown too far apart over the years and now want very different things out of life and love. Or maybe one person very much wants to keep fighting for the relationship, but the other partner consistently doesn't show up and isn't willing to do their part. In some cases, a relationship is in such a high degree of conflict, dysfunction, or toxicity that the only healthy thing to do is move on. How then do we really know when our relationship is simply going through a rough patch that needs more tending to, is in a critical condition that needs more urgent interventions, or is over and done with? Some relationship patterns can muddy the waters and make it difficult to determine whether or not a relationship is worth saving. What I see a lot is that many partners who are struggling look to non-monogamy as the potential solution to their problems without realizing opening up, introducing new partners, or changing the CNM style they have been practicing can actually hasten the end instead of preventing it. While in some cases CNM could be helpful for relieving the tensions and challenges of a rocky relationship, in many cases, partners are grappling with situations where ending the relationship is probably best, regardless of whether or not they are exploring CNM. In situations like these, the severity of the conflict and emotional difficulties isn't good for either person. And frankly, there isn't enough desire, capacity, or goodwill on either part to really do what would be necessary to change things. In some more extreme cases, partners are trying to initiate a CNM transition while in the midst of massive dysfunction, toxicity, or crisis. And it's not that the crack is too big, but that it's an actual sinkhole. Thankfully, this category represents a relative minority when it comes to the people I work with seeking support for their CNM process. However, it is worth mentioning because many people out there still hope CNM will be the life support system for a relationship better left unresurrected. For some, the stigma of divorce or the fear of being alone can be so strong that they would rather try non-monogamy than break up with someone who is mistreating them or with whom they are clearly incompatible. CNM should not be used as a way to avoid having to make a hard choice about leaving an unhealthy or abusive relationship. If anything, the decision to become non-monogamous will just complicate your life in ways that will only make matters worse. Additionally, people practicing CNM are not immune to abusive dynamics. Individuals who are already non-monogamous can find themselves in dysfunctional situations with one or more of their partners, like anyone else. Just because someone has multiple partners does not mean the abuse they experience in a particular relationship is any less severe than if they're monogamous. Just as the fear of being shamed or stigmatized can keep someone from revealing or seeking help for the abuse they experience in monogamous relationships, so too can it prevent CNM folks from speaking up. In fact, in some cases, people in CNM relationships can be even more susceptible to the silence and isolation that can obscure abuse because of the added stigmas and stereotypes that are often projected onto non-monogamy. The fear of being judged, dismissed, or having their CNM lifestyle or identity blamed as the cause of their abuse can make the obstacles to telling the truth feel even more overwhelming. In a situation where someone is enduring outright contempt, neglect, or abuse, the only thing I can ethically recommend is either radical therapeutic intervention where these issues are addressed and the abusive partner takes responsibility for the actions, or putting an end to the relationship. Some clear examples of things that signal the need to end a relationship are: your partner intimidates you through threatening looks or actions. Your partner makes threats to harm you or your children. Your partner has an active addiction for which they are not seeking treatment. Your partner exhibits extreme jealousy when you spend time away from them, or jealousy towards your friends. Your partner isolates you or discourages you from spending time with friends, family members, or peers. Your partner is insulting, demeaning, or shaming towards you, especially in front of other people, and is not willing to stop or address these behaviors. Your partner is preventing you from making your own decisions, including decisions about your own life, your work, schooling, other relationships, etc. Your partner controls your finances, and you are unable to have money for necessary expenses or to leave the relationship. Your partner pressures you to use drugs or alcohol or perform sexual acts you're not comfortable with or consenting to. Your partner damages or destroys your belongings. Your partner tries to convince you, your other partners, your metamours, or someone else that you are crazy. Your partner does other things not mentioned above that leave you feeling physically, emotionally, or mentally unsafe. If you are experiencing any of the above situations, it is important that you prioritize your own physical, emotional, and psychological well-being, as well as that of your children and other loved ones who might be in harm's way. If you are in a dynamic where you feel your safety is compromised, you need to get out of that situation. With that said, in some cases, healing and treatment for high conflict relationships is actually possible, where everyone involved would enter into some form of recovery or therapy treatment. If partners are equally combative, explosive, mutually triggering, and consistently bringing out the worst in each other, then an intensive period of individual therapy or even inpatient or outpatient treatment along with relationship counseling holds the possibility of really changing things. In cases like these, it's critical that everyone take responsibility for their part in the unhealthy dynamic, and time apart might be warranted. If you haven't given the relationship the opportunity to try some professional intervention, then at the very least, a reasonable hope remains that there could still be something left to salvage. But again, only if all parties are clear about the way they're contributing to the toxic dynamic and committed to getting help and changing. This is by far not an easy path or one that is guaranteed to work. Sometimes the responsibility for relationship challenges is not equally shared between all parties, and one person actually needs more help, as in the case of addiction or severe PTSD. In special cases like these, everyone involved will most likely need support, but it's important to recognize that because of the long-standing effects of traumatic life circumstances, one partner can be particularly primed to struggle with conflict and attachment issues. There is absolutely no shame in naming the imbalance in a dynamic such as this. And in many cases, this can actually be the very key to restoring balance in the relationship. When we clearly identify what is ours to work on, we can start to take full responsibility for our part in a problematic dynamic. For some, it's vital that they take ownership for their personal issues such as addiction, uncontrollable anger, insecurities, reactivity, attachment wounds, etc. And for others, doing the inner work consists precisely of developing the self-worth necessary to no longer tolerate abusive or toxic behaviors from their partners. Chapter conclusion. After reading this chapter, I understand how the thought of having to face these kinds of challenges could seem daunting. And while they do represent many of the common issues that arise as partners navigate CNM, the point of looking at them is not to overwhelm you, but instead to make them explicit, so you can either recognize them for what they are and develop the awareness to change them, or ideally circumvent them altogether. As I mentioned at the beginning of this chapter, CNM offers the promise of genuine, profound personal transformation and greater relational intimacy. The trick is to intentionally embrace all the difficult lessons that arise along the way in order to reap those benefits.